questions about anything? So the plan kind of is to break into chapter 18 maybe today and continue it on Wednesday. I've been talking about this list of stars that you need to know. I think we'll have our first quiz on it on Wednesday. It'll be much as anything else for practice. I'll give you a sheet of paper like this that has dots and lines for the two stars that are just isolated in constellation. Most of the stars are in collections of constellations, like the Summer Triangle. But Polaris and Algol are not part of a larger group. And so the plan is that you will point at the star, give the name of the star, and report the spectral type of the star. Then we'll go on to bigger point problems on Friday and et cetera. And then it'll be a 10-point question on the next exam, which is just before Thanksgiving. Don't forget your home labs. They're due at Thanksgiving. It's not the sort of thing you can do the night before. Give it some thought well before you have to turn it in. Questions? So we have labs not this week, but next week. So 2 times ago, we kind of made a comparison between the sun and the stars. Sun is a star. Because it's the closest star, there are lots of things we know about it that we don't know about the other stars. In particular, we have really good numbers for the distance to that star, and we have the ability to do seismometry on it to kind of look inside the star. If you look at kind of the first thing in the chapter that we can't apply to the sun, it's the velocity. So we're talking about the velocity of stars relative to the sun, and the kind of easiest thing to measure and historically kind of the second thing that was measured, right? So Hipparchus wrote down locations of stars and his estimate of the magnitude of star. Kind of the next thing to do is to look at changing right ascension and declination of stars over the centuries. That's what proper motion is. So proper motion is the change in the shape of the constellations over time because the stars are changing their right ascension and declination. Not a lot, not enough that you would ever notice it, but just by your eye, but a little bit, right? So here's for example the situation with the Big Dipper. So it turns out that most of the stars of the Big Dipper are going in one direction, but the tail stars are going in distinct directions. But you know, you can look back at Hipparchus and the shape of the constellation Big Dipper. To your eye, it looks pretty much the same. These are all very small motions with time. Now, the change in angle with time depends on how far something is away. If it's really far away, even if it's moving pretty fast, its angle won't change very, very fast. If we know the distance and the proper motion, then we can get the tangential velocity, how far it's going sideways, right? If it's just going towards us or away from us, it's not going to have any proper motion, and we wouldn't measure that component. But by the Doppler effect, we can measure the radial velocity. And we can put those numbers together, and we can get the space velocity. And, I don't know, roughly speaking, this is kind of what that data looks like. Kind of no surprise, the stars have kind of random velocities. There are a handful of stars that are moving very, very fast. And turns out, kind of surprisingly, you would think that proper motion isn't going to get you very far. But surprisingly, you can learn a fair amount from proper motion, and as I say, it's one of the first things that you could actually measure about stars. Kind of at best, it gives you an indirect idea about how far a star is away, because if it has a very small proper motion, it's probably pretty far away. It's pretty unlikely that it's pointed right at the Earth. So then we talked about types of binary stars. We have fake binary stars, which just happen to be in the same direction. So they look like they're together. But if we follow stars over the decades, we see that some stars are in fact orbiting around other stars. So here's some data that shows a visible binary star where we see two dots and we see one dot moving around each other. Astrometric binaries are cases where we just see one dot and it's going around in a circle. So we intuit that there has to be something that we're not seeing, some dark star that's bending its motion. Stars have different spectra, and we'll talk more about that in a second. So sometimes when we take the spectra of a star, we see a composite spectra, a spectra that includes things that can only exist at low temperature, like molecules, and things that can only exist at high temperature, like ionized helium. So the interpretation is that there are two stars there, and we're just seeing the combined light from both of those stars. Spectroscopic binaries are cases where we see moving lines. So we see absorption lines. So in this sort of circumstance, A is moving towards us and B is moving away from us. So it should be one line is split. Here they're both moving sideways, so those lines come together. Here we have the reverse situation. So we see the lines that make up the spectra of the star moving back and forth, and we interpret that as a Doppler effect. So that we're interpreting that one star goes in front of the other, or excuse me, is rotating around each other. We can also have eclipsing binary stars where we do have one star that's going through each other. Under those circumstances, the light is going to dim. So here we have the brightness versus time. When one star is partially blocking out the other, we're going to see a reduction in light. Right, so this is the case of Algol, for example, where we have a kind of a full magnitude drop in the brightness of the star. Okay, so a long list of types of binary stars. Most stars are binary, or multiple, maybe I should say. That's why binary is in quotes there, because there are lots of stars that are made up of three stars, four stars, five stars. So we talked about Mizar, which is actually made up out of four stars. We have a visual binary pair, and each one of those dots that we see is actually a spectroscopic binary. So the sun is a little bit unusual in being a solitary star. So Hipparchus kind of by eye created this magnitude system, which we're kind of stuck with. If we try and make equations that more or less reproduce what Hipparchus' eye said, it turns out that the magnitude system is a logarithmic system, which is to say it's based on exponents and ratios. And these days, the definition of a magnitude is that we look at the fraction of the starlight compared to the star Vega. So typically, Vega is a pretty bright star, so typically this is a fraction that's less than one, and if you take the log of a number that's less than one, you get a negative sign, which is how this negative sign gets canceled out and how, you know, a typical star like Algol could have a magnitude 2, for example. So this formula, you really can't apply it because it implies that you would know the total brightness of the star at all wavelengths of light. And some wavelengths of light are absorbed by the Earth's atmosphere. The detector you use probably won't simultaneously measure all the colors of light from radio to gamma rays. So kind of to take cognizant of that, these days typically people look at the brightness of a star through a variety of definite filters that we all agree on. So we have a piece of glass that only lets ultraviolet light through it, that's the U filter. We have a piece of glass that only lets blue light through it, that's the blue filter, and so it goes. So we do this same process. We look at the brightness of the star, say, through the blue filter, and we compare it to the brightness of Vega through the blue filter, and we do the same thing, and we get the so-called blue magnitude. So once we've got the amount of light in these various ranges of types of light, we can look at the ratio of the amount of light. And if we look at the ratio of the amount of visible light, which is actually kind of green, to the ratio of the amount of blue light, if it's a cool star, there won't be much blue light and there'll be lots of visible light, so that ratio will be large. On the other hand, if we have a very hot star, there'll be lots of blue light, more blue light than visible light, and that ratio will be less than one. So this ratio gives us an estimate of the temperature of the star. If that number is large, the star is cool. So one of the reasons for looking at ratios is ideally it should be independent of distance, right? The light is just going to be more and more diluted if we move the star away. Both the blue light and the visible light will be decreased by, say, a tenth if we have moved the star further out. So the ratio will be independent of distance. And that's why we're measuring an intensive property that's related to temperature as opposed to an extensive quantity like luminosity. Turns out that we can look at the ratio of the brightness and the visible light and the blue light by just subtracting the magnitudes. So if we take the blue magnitude and subtract the V magnitude, we get something that is directly related to the ratio. So again, if B minus V is large, the star is going to be cool. So B minus V's kind of range for stars from maybe minus 0.2 to one or two, something like that. Absolute magnitude. So you remember luminosity is the total wattage of the star, and absolute magnitude is an attempt to put luminosity on the same logarithmic scale as we have for magnitude. And the idea is we're going to calculate, and of course our calculations could go wrong, we're going to calculate the brightness of the star as if it were at a distance of 10 parsecs. So you remember a parsec means a parallax of one arc second, 10 parallax, about 33 light years. It's just kind of a random distance that people use to standardize the brightness of stars. So if we did, and again, we don't really care a whole lot about the algebra here, but we denote absolute magnitudes by uppercase m's, and we denote what we previously called magnitudes, apparent magnitudes, by lowercase m's. And the upshot is if we look at the difference between the apparent magnitude and the absolute magnitude, it's positively related to the distance. And so it's called the distance modulus. So if we have the absolute magnitude and the apparent magnitude, we can calculate the distance modulus and we can order stars according to their distance. Type of spectra. So if you look at the spectra of stars, they have, you know, different things absorbing in their atmosphere, and the reason for that is high temperatures break apart composites. So on the hottest stars, we have lines from ionized helium. In the coolest stars, we have lines that are coming from molecules, and different stars have different spectras. And it shouldn't imply that this is an absolute distinction, like male or female. There are all the possible in-between cases, too. So for historical reasons, these things are listed in temperature order, OBA, fine girl, kiss me, and then in the last 10 years we've discovered two cooler classes of stars that are called L and T stars. So again, the O stars are the hottest stars. They show absorption lines from ionized helium. In the A stars, the hydrogen absorption lines are particularly strong. For the F, G, and K stars, the metals have strong absorption lines. And in the M stars, we have the absorption lines for molecules. And the in-between cases are denoted by numbers following that. So it turns out that the hottest star we know of is an O3. O9 would be the coolest O star, and then we start B0 through B9, A0 through A9, etc. So the Sun turns out to be a G2 star. So the Roman numeral 5 that follows that designation is what's called the luminosity class, and that comes from a realization that the density of the atmosphere can control how prominent the absorption line is. If the molecules are packed cheek to jowl, the energy level that produces an absorption line will be not a particular level. It'll have a variety of perturbed values based on the presence of nearby molecules. So the line will be broad if we have a dense atmosphere. If we have a rarefied atmosphere, the line will be narrow. And so as a result, we have luminosity class. So luminosity class 1 are the most rarefied atmosphere stars. They're the ones that are most expanded. They're called supergiants. Here's kind of another view of the same thing. So here we have a relatively broad line. This is going to be a class 5. Main sequence, or dwarf, is the name of that. Here we have a narrow line that's going to be a supergiant star. Okay, and in-between things are in-between. So we have bright giants and subgiants, and so it goes. Questions on all of that? So if you remember, one of the big questions on the exam that you didn't take was a list of stars with spectral types and absolute magnitudes, and then you were supposed to answer questions about it. So, you know, that's a sort of question I like. Answering questions about which one is the hottest star, you're going to use the letter will tell you that. In terms of the distance to those stars, you can use the distance modulus to do that. You can subtract the absolute magnitude from the apparent magnitude, and the bigger number will be the furthest away star. And generally speaking, the brighter stars, the large radius stars, are going to be the luminosity class 1 stars. Okay, questions? Okay, so kind of the two main things, hope to do more than just this, but the two kind of most important things in this lecture are going to be the HR diagram. Stands for Hertzsprung-Russell. Two astronomers, Hertzsprung I think was Danish, Russell is an American, who were working circa 1900, and what's called the Russell-Voigt theorem. So this is the second theorem, right? We had the Virial theorem before. This is another sort of theorem. So Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. So Hertzsprung-Russell diagram is an attempt to relate an intensive quantity, like temperature, to an extensive quantity, like luminosity. Okay, so more is more for luminosity. For temperature of a star, more isn't necessarily more. And there are lots of ways we can do that. Here's an example of an HR diagram. So on the y-axis, we're going to have the wattage of the star, the luminosity of the star. This could be the absolute magnitude of the star. Those are all intimately related. Where we have bright stuff, intrinsically bright stuff up here, and we have intrinsically dim stuff down there. For the x-axis, we're going to have some measurement of an intensive quantity of the star, namely its temperature. So we're going to do this backwards for historical reasons. That is to say, the hottest stars are going to be over here, and the coolest stars are going to be over there. So we could do that with spectral type. We could do that with a measurement of temperature that's based on looking at the absorption lines in detail. We could do that with a color index. All of those things are measurements of the temperature and would make perfectly good x-axes. Okay, so we're going to be describing lots of phenomena on this HR diagram, and it's important to remember, so here we have temperature one way or the other, with hot here, cool there, and here we have brightness or luminosity. And here we have bright and dim. And you might remember this theoretical formula that occurred a few review boards back, and that is that we should be able to calculate the luminosity based on the temperature, because of course, the higher the temperature, the brighter the object intrinsically. So that's the so-called Stefan-Boltzmann rule. And then bigger stars have more emitting area, so they should be brighter too. So there's an interrelationship between the luminosity and the temperature and the radius. And at least theoretically, if you know two out of those things, you should be able to calculate the third. So the big radius stars are going to be stars that have a relatively low temperature but still have a pretty big luminosity. And so we can label the locations of different radius stars on the HR diagram as kind of funny diagonal lines. So here we have the same sort of diagram. Here's luminosity, here's temperature. And here we have lines of constant radius. So the biggest radius stars, so these are stars in particular that would have a radius 1,000 times the radius of the sun, they are going to be relatively luminous but cool stars. Anything on that line would have a radius that would be 1,000 times the radius of the sun. Here's the set of points that would represent stars that have a radius that is 100 times the sun and 10 times the sun. And the sun size, and then even smaller stars than the sun on these various diagonal lines. Okay, so lines of constant radius look kind of like that, and bigger radius goes out kind of like that. Okay, so if we locate a star's temperature, luminosity, and radius, it's going to be a dot on this diagram. So, for example, Algol, for example, remember it's a binary star since it's eclipsing. One of those stars is a B main sequence star, and it turns out it would have a spot kind of like that on this diagram. Polaris is a F supergiant star, so it's not as bright, it's not as hot as the hot component of Algol, but it's brighter, it would have a dot that's kind of like there. Betelgeuse is a very cool but very luminous star. It would be a dot kind of like there. Now we're going to talk about stars moving on the HR diagram, and that can be confusing. I'm not talking about them moving through space. That would have to do with proper motion. I'm talking about them changing their temperature, radius, and luminosity. And obviously that doesn't happen over kind of human lifetimes, right? The sun has had pretty much the same temperature and luminosity over my lifetime. But over billions of years, the sun's luminosity and temperature and radius are changing. So if we go back 4 billion years, the sun was only about 70% as luminous as it is today, and it's gradually getting more luminous. So I could say over billions of years, the sun has a motion on the HR diagram that's kind of like that. It's getting brighter, getting a slightly larger radius, more or less the same temperature. Okay, so the way we're going to have to describe changes in stars over billions of years is by motions on the HR diagram. So if we look at the run of stars, so I'm tempted to say that this is a random collection of stars, but that's not really exactly true. And maybe it's good to start out with that sort of statement. Yeah, it's also not a random collection of stars. So the red boxes are what we think is a fairly random collection of stars. It's all of the stars that are within that we know about that are within 15 light years of the Earth. And you can see that most of the stars, there are some exceptions, most of the stars are relatively cool, relatively small radius stars. So those most prominent, most common types of stars down here, those are main sequence M stars. On the other hand, the red triangles are the stars that are bright in our sky. So these are the stars that have names, right? Like Capella and Arcturus and Betelgeuse. Right? Presumably that dot is Betelgeuse. And you can see that they're a different population. Generally speaking, these are luminosity class 1 or 2 or 3 stars that are bright in our sky, not because they're close, but because they're hugely bright. And again, it might be worth spending a second to look at the scales of the HR diagram, because there's a huge range in luminosity for stars. Roughly speaking, stars can be a million times brighter than the sun, or they could be a millionth the brightness of the sun. So there's a huge range in luminosity. There's a pretty big range in temperature, but it's only more like a factor of 10. There's a pretty big range in radius, right, out to 1,000 times the size of the sun, and it turns out that there are stars that are called white dwarfs that are on the order of 1/100th the size of the sun. Okay, so an absolutely phenomenal range in wattage of stars, a pretty big range in radius of stars, a moderately big range in the temperature of stars. Okay, so most of the stars that have names are prominent in our sky because they are some sort of giant star. On the other hand, most of the stars in our galaxy, we think, are not particularly bright stars. They lie along this axis, this collection of points, which is the main sequence. So the sun is currently a main sequence star. It has been a main sequence star for the last 4 billion years, 5 billion years. It will be a main sequence star for the next 5 billion years. But over time, it will evolve into these other sorts of stars. If you look at that list of prominent stars. The sun would be about here. Most of those are, in fact, cooler than the sun is and less luminous. So the sun is not exactly a typical star. It's brighter than the typical star, hotter than the typical star, but it's still a main sequence star. So an actually typical star would be main sequence, cooler and dimmer than the sun. Most of the bright stars, on the other hand, would be these giants and supergiants, which are prominent in our sky simply because they are huge. So why? Why, instead of the stars being kind of at random spots on this diagram, why do they mostly populate this band? And that has to do with the Russell-Voigt theorem. So the Russell-Voigt theorem says what causes the properties of stars. And it says that the properties of stars, and by properties I include temperature and luminosity and radius, all the properties of stars are determined by two things. One of them is the composition, the chemical composition. But remember, we've said lots of times that the chemical compositions of stars are pretty much all the same. So that's usually not the important factor in determining what a star is about. The other one is the important factor, and that's the mass. But if you tell me the mass and the composition of a star, I can tell you, or Russell and Voigt at least could tell you, what the temperature and luminosity and radius and all of the innards of that star would be about. And again, since roughly speaking the composition of stars is all the same, right, 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, and we can disagree about exactly how much of the else there's going to be, few percent to a hundredth of a percent, something like that. The main deal is the mass. And indeed, if we look at the mass of the stars on the main sequence, and of course we can't tell the mass of a typical star. In order to tell the mass of a star, we have to have a binary star situation. It has to be relatively close. But if we look at the masses of the stars that we can measure, we find that there is a relationship between the mass of the star and the location on this diagram. The low mass stars are all at the cool end, and the high mass stars are all at the high end. So roughly speaking, it turns out that the luminosity of a star is roughly proportional to the mass to the fourth power. So a small change in the mass makes a pretty big difference in the luminosity of that star. If you look at the radius of these stars, you can see that the more massive stars have a bigger radius and the lower mass stars have a smaller radius, but roughly, approximately speaking, the radius is more or less constant. If we look in detail, we can see that the smaller the mass, the smaller the radius of the star. But the huge differences in radii that we're talking about, they're not due to mass. By talking about the main sequence stars, we're describing more than 99% of all of the stars. But how about those stars that are exceptional? These very bright stars. What's going on with them? Well, apparently it can't be mass, right? Because mass is causing this. So the oddballs, right, the things that aren't main sequence, it's got to be the other thing. It's got to be composition. But if I use my spectrometer to measure the composition of Betelgeuse, say, what I find is that it reads 75% hydrogen, 25% helium, just like any other star. Well, that just tells us that it's not the composition on the outside that's changing. Because we can only measure the composition of the atmosphere. We can't see inside the interior of the star with visible light. So it must be the interior composition. We can't see that, but the Russell-Voigt theorem tells us that if the mass is the same and the outside composition is the same, but the stars are different, it must be the interior composition that's different. And if you think about it, that makes sense, because the sun is gradually changing its composition. It's changing hydrogen into helium. So these stars are stars that have, we use the word evolved, but that's not a very good word. Aged would be a better word. So they're aged stars with changed internal composition. So that's going to be the topic really of Wednesday's lecture. How exactly does this come about? What is the lifespan of stars? But today in chapter 18, we're going to take up kind of the first topic, and that's how stars are born. Okay, so all of these stars that are so-called evolved stars are stars that have been around long enough that they've changed their internal composition. Instead of being hydrogen on the inside, they're probably helium on the inside because they've converted all of their hydrogen to helium. Now, I have to be a little bit careful about talking about them being old stars because it turns out that stars burn at hugely different rates. So that a star like Rigel has a lifetime that is way shorter than the sun's lifetime. So this star, which is currently, I think it's a supergiant star, it hasn't lived as long as the sun has lived. So it's not literally older than the sun, but more massive stars age faster than the sun. They have an overall lifetime that's shorter. So it's dog years versus people years sort of thing. So kind of why is that the case? Well, we've said that the brightness of a star goes roughly like the mass to the fourth power. And if we think about kind of your car, there are two things that we worry about for how far that car can go, right? How big is the fuel tank and what are the miles per gallon? And the same thing is going to be applied to stars, right? The size of the fuel tank is the mass, because most of the mass of the star is made out of hydrogen, which is nicely burnable to produce energy. So the total stock of fuel we have is related to the mass. The rate at which we're burning it, you know, kind of the miles per gallon, that's the luminosity. So if we take the size of our fuel tank, mass, and we divide into it the rate that we're going through that fuel, the luminosity, we're going to get something that is related to an inverse power of mass. So higher mass stars, a star that weighs twice as much as the sun, is going to have a lifetime that is going to be 1/8 the lifetime of the sun. So again, relatively small differences in the mass of stars make huge differences in how long those stars are around. So it turns out that every star like these down here that has ever been produced in the universe, it's still shining. None of them have died yet. The sun has a total lifetime that is comparable to the lifetime of the universe. So some stars like the sun have been born and died, but most of the stars like the sun that have been born in the universe are still shining. Stars like Rigel and Vega, they have very short lifetimes. So you can think of those as insects that have, you know, live just a year compared to human beings that are living 100 times as long. Butterflies as opposed to elephants. Although you can see the result is exactly the reverse, right? The elephant weighs a lot, but it lives a long time. Yeah, so I always have to be careful because things are astronomically different in astronomy, right? So a short lifetime star, so a really short lifetime star would be maybe 10 million years. So the sun is 10 billion years. So it's a much longer sort of time, and the age of the universe is 13.7 billion years. Solar system has been around so far for 4.7 billion years. So the sun's about halfway through its lifetime. More questions? So the sun is gradually changing its composition from being 75% hydrogen in the core to being 100% helium in the core, but it hasn't changed enough to change its overall, so it's gradually changing its luminosity, but it's still a main sequence star. It's still mostly hydrogen on the inside. Okay, so HR diagram is a way of simultaneously displaying the radius, the luminosity, and the temperature of stars. And we're going to use it a whole lot to talk about how stars change. So, for example, you don't have to write this down, but this will be kind of a test question in the future. It turns out that the history of the sun looks kind of like that. The sun changing its radius and luminosity over time. It started out as a huge, cool object, and it's going to end up as a, at least starting out, as a very hot, very small object, which literally just cools off then through the rest of time. So that's what we're working our way up to be able to describe in more or less detail what the future and past of the sun is. Okay, so to start that process, we have to talk about how stars are born. And of course, they have to be born from something, right? There's a lot of mass in a star. Where does that mass come from? So we think about space as being empty, but there is gas in space. So what's the form of this gas? And I kind of don't like how the book deals with it. Here's a different take. This is Wiki's take on it. So here we have a list of possible types of gas that we find in space. And we'll kind of go through these types of gas. And in one kind of comprehensive place, whereas I think the book spreads this out over a variety of places. And let's kind of start at the back end, the end that's least important for star evolution. And that's at the bottom of this table, where we're talking about very hot gas that is very rarefied. It's excellent vacuum. So I call this hot vacuum. This right up here is calling this the coronal gas. And they're calling it the coronal gas because the temperature of this gas is comparable to the temperature of the corona, millions of degrees hot. Not as hot as the center of the sun, but the coronal gas that we have at the sun, but it's the least dense. It's almost not there. So if you look at that chart, something like, on average, a hundredth of a molecule per cubic centimeter, right? So this says between a 10,000th and a 100th of a molecule per cubic centimeter. So stuff like this is very unlikely to become stars. It's very rarefied gas. And we think that the origin of this coronal gas is exploding stars. So stars that are exploding are called supernovas. Relatively rare occurrence. So I'm currently looking at the first one I've actually measured in my lifetime that exploded in a nearby galaxy, M101. On average, they happen a few centuries, but it's been a while since there's been one visible. It's been a while since there's been one visible from the Northern Hemisphere. In 1987, there was a famous one that was visible from the Southern Hemisphere. And mostly our interest in this hot vacuum is going to be because in this exploding star, it's going to push around the other gases and potentially compress them to make these other sorts of stuff. So you can think kind of a snowplow sort of effect. When a star explodes, it's going to pile together a lot of this other gas to make these other types of gas. So I said this sort of gas exists. How do we find it? So it's very rarefied, so there's not much there. It's all ionized, so there aren't any atoms, there aren't any electrons that could be jumping up and down that are connected to those atoms. And what's going on with this very hot stuff is Bremsstrahlung. So you remember Bremsstrahlung is where electrons came quickly to rest. So it's that sort of stuff. We have electrons that are flying by nuclei, and they're producing X-rays. So this is a relatively recent discovery when we could put satellites above the Earth's atmosphere to detect those X-rays. Okay, so coronal gas. I like the name hot vacuum because I think it's pretty descriptive. Very high temperature, very low density stuff. Probably related to exploding stars, so-called supernova remnants. So if we look, and I hope we will do this in lab, if we look around the star Betelgeuse, if we look around the star that is in the Sword of Orion, we see a bright spot in the sky, a fuzzy spot in the sky, which is the Orion Nebula. Have I lost the Orion Nebula? It's not there. It's not there. It's not there. Okay, so. So here's the constellation. We've got stars, which are on the list of things to know, Betelgeuse and Rigel. So this is the so-called belt of Orion, these three stars in a row. So this is the shield of Orion. He's got a club that he's holding up. So this is usually called the sword that's hanging down from his belt. And the middle star of that belt is not a star. It's four stars close together, but it's... mostly what we're seeing there is illuminated gas. So here's again a close-up of those three stars. You can see that these guys are dots, and this guy is extended, an extended fuzzy area. Incidentally, the Horsehead Nebula, which is famous for books, is kind of up there. And this is, of course, a terrible picture of it in this light. Here's kind of what we see. Extended illuminated gas. So these are H2 regions. So this is gas that is being illuminated by four very hot stars that are at the base of this nebula And those stars, since they're very hot, are producing lots of ultraviolet light. So kind of the picture you should have of the Orion Nebula in particular is there's this big cloud of gas we'll talk about in a second, and there are these four stars, the trapezium stars, that are ionizing the gas that's kind of in a bubble on the edge of this giant cloud of gas. And the UV light is knocking the electrons in that gas to high energy states, and as they come back down, they're producing the colors of light we see, right? It's fluorescent, it's just like is occurring in the light bulbs. So the fall back down is producing an emission spectra. So, kind of by definition, O stars don't live very long. So this is a relatively new phenomena in this point in space, right? The O star will be dead in, 10 million years, 100 million years. So this has to be near where stars have formed, because those O stars formed in the last few million years. But it's not actually part of the star formation process. It's a sign of the early life of stars. So this has to do with fresh star life, but not actual birth. Incidentally, there's a very similar thing that we've talked about that actually has to do with the death of stars. So you remember from Lab 2, we talked about planetary nebula. Right, like the Ring Nebula. And if you remember what those things kind of look like, we have a very hot star that's right at the middle, and it's illuminating the gas around it. So it's pretty much the same process. We have a hot UV-producing star, and we have gas surrounding it that is being illuminated by that light. It's being excited. When it falls back down, it's producing the light we see, and typically in kind of a ring that's surrounding the central star. So it's the same sort of story, but it's actually a little bit different. This is a dying star, and this is the atmosphere of that star that has been puffed off. Okay, so in a typical H2 region like the Orion Nebula, the gas is kind of leftover gas from the formation of those stars a few million years ago, now being illuminated by these short-lived, high-mass, high-temperature O stars. The planetary nebula more has to do with the death of stars. The gas that's around is gas that was part of that star that has been puffed off. And the thing that's illuminating it is the ember that's left over in the death of that star. But in both cases, it's gas that's being illuminated by ultraviolet light and being excited. When the electrons fall back down to the ground state, they're going to produce an emission spectra. Okay, so similar but opposite, kind of. And these guys we can see in visible light, right? Since I've been showing you visible pictures of it, so that's how we detect it. Since the most common stuff of the universe is hydrogen, hydrogen is a good thing to look at, to see these things, and the red light, and which maybe looks kind of pinkish here, the red light that's in this emission nebula is that hydrogen emission line that we saw with the hydrogen tube over there. Oxygen is also not a particularly uncommon element, and it turns out that we also see emission lines from oxygen in H2 regions. Okay, so this gas is on the order of 10,000 degrees hot. And you can see that roughly speaking, we're talking about pretty dense stuff. Hundreds of molecules per cubic centimeter. And it can be a lot denser than that or lighter than that, since it's kind of leftover clouds, so it's no surprise that it varies in density over huge scale. And these, both of these objects, planetary nebula and H2 regions, are relatively short-lived things because they both depend on the exciting light of something that isn't going to live very long. So in this case, we're getting close to star birth. Here, this is star death. But we're still not actually at the location of star birth. So if we're thinking about forming stars, what we're going to want is dense gas. And maybe it's not obvious, but cool gas is also important. The reason we want it cool is that you remember that there's an escape velocity, and temperature is a measurement of how fast those atoms are going. So if we have hot gas, the atoms are going to escape before they come to form the star. So what we're looking for locations of star birth is dense gas that is also cool. And that should sound a little bit problematic, because if it is cool gas, how is it going to produce any light that we can actually see? So we're looking for very unenergetic electron jumps that would actually produce light that we could see. And of course, among the least energetic photons that we've talked about are going to be radio light. So we should be thinking about using radio telescopes to detect these very low energy situations that might be conducive to star formation. So what's about the lowest energy jump that we can have for the most common element that we know about? So if we think about hydrogen, kind of the simple picture is we've got a proton in the nucleus and we've got an orbiting electron. And this is cool, so this electron is going to be in the ground state, and it takes a huge amount of energy, an ultraviolet photon, in order to knock that electron out of the ground state. So we're not going to see any big electron jumps. So it turns out there's a really slight effect, and that is that both the electron and the proton are actually spinning on their axes just the way the Earth is spinning. So the electron is orbiting, and I guess technically speaking, the proton has to be orbiting too. So the electron is orbiting and also spinning. And you remember that charge that is in motion is going to produce a magnetic field. That's how the magnetic field of the sun is made, by having electric currents that are moving. It's how electromagnets work. So like an electromagnet, we can think about this spinning proton as producing a magnetic field. And same thing for the electron, we can think about this electron as a little magnet too. And those magnets are going to have low energy if they are spinning in opposite directions than if they're spinning in the same direction, right? Just as we're going to have a lower energy situation if the south and the north poles are together, and if we twist this bar magnet around, it's going to take some energy to do that. So these are microscopic particles that are, they're spinning pretty fast, I guess, but they're producing pretty microscopic magnetic fields. So all of this is really small energy jumps to go from an excited state where the electron and the proton are spinning in the same direction to a low energy state where they're spinning in the opposite directions. And it turns out that this very small energy jump produces radio light that has a wavelength of about 21 centimeters. And it's a great way to detect gas. Okay, so these are the various atomic clouds. And we have clouds that are of pretty high temperature, but I'm actually focusing more on these atomic clouds that have temperatures of around 100 degrees. This is 100 degrees above absolute zero, so this is about the temperature of liquid nitrogen, so it's pretty cold, and have densities that are on the order of 100 particles per cubic centimeter. Still excellent vacuum by any sort of considerations. So we can tune our radio telescopes to 21 centimeters, and we can look for emission lines or absorption lines due to this jump of the electron having its spin aligned with the spin of the proton or spin not aligned with it. And it's about the smallest imaginable jump you can have for an electron, so it's about the lowest energy photon you can imagine to be found. But you can see we haven't reached the densest and coldest stuff yet. So this is molecular hydrogen, and this is called molecular clouds. So here we were talking about atomic hydrogen. So now we're thinking about hydrogen the way it is inside of a hydrogen balloon, which are two H atoms bound together. And it turns out under these circumstances, this same sort of energy jump that we talked about for the atomic hydrogen doesn't exist. The energy levels are different for the molecule than they are for the atom, kind of no surprise. And it really looks bad. You pretty much cannot detect molecular hydrogen at these low temperatures. You can detect it in absorption. That is to say, if you have a star that's behind that cloud of gas, the hydrogen gas will absorb some colors of light, particularly ultraviolet light, and you can detect that. But that's not a good way to detect things because it requires a hot star that happens to be in the same line as this cloud of gas. So, pretty much have to rule out hydrogen, molecular hydrogen, as something we can actually see. But while the universe is mostly hydrogen, it's not exclusively hydrogen. So how about other stuff? Well, helium is an inert gas. And it turns out that kind of for the same reason that hydrogen doesn't have any spin jumps, helium doesn't have any spin jumps. Helium is even more undetectable. Well, it's exactly as detectable as I guess hydrogen is. It requires a very hot star that's behind it to produce absorption of ultraviolet photons. So if we go down the list from hydrogen and helium and we're into the else then kind of the next most common things are carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen. Remember, we kind of jump over the next elements in the periodic table for reasons that need to be explained. And it turns out that what is a deadly gas for us in our furnaces these times, carbon monoxide, CO, does produce radio light. So what is special about carbon monoxide in contrast to H2 that allows carbon monoxide to produce radio light and so able to detect it, whereas we can't detect the very common H2 that is in those molecular molecular lines. And the answer has to do with accelerating charge again, because accelerating charge is going to produce light. So H2 is perfectly symmetric since it's two protons. So when it rotates around, it doesn't produce any radio light. The dissymmetry between carbon and oxygen, because it's not a homonuclear diatomic molecule, allows it, when it rotates, to produce radio light. So it's rotational speed jump. So we have this molecule that's rotating around at some speed. If it increases speed or decreases speed, then it produces radio light that we can detect. Okay, so we've got the molecular clouds, which are mostly made out of molecular hydrogen, but we can't detect the molecular hydrogen. Instead, we look for a relatively rare impurity that's in those clouds, namely carbon monoxide, and that we can detect. We have the atomic hydrogen clouds, where the hydrogen has been broken apart into individual hydrogen atoms. The spin flip light allows us to detect those guys. If we have an exciting ultraviolet source, we can have H2 regions or planetary nebula, which are producing an emission spectrum. And we have the very hot gas, the coronal gas, that's being produced from Bremsstrahlung. Okay, so it's in these giant molecular clouds, which take up a relatively small fraction of space. Notice that this hot gas takes up a good fraction of the space. So the molecular clouds are a relatively small fraction of space, but they are cold and dense, and they're the candidate spots for star formation. And remember I said that the Orion Nebula was kind of a blister on the surface of this cloud. That cloud was a giant molecular cloud. So we can detect these giant molecular clouds from the light from the carbon monoxide that they're producing. And if we look inside of these giant molecular clouds, not uncommonly we see hot spots in them, which seem to be stars in formation. Now again, the process of star formation is a process of millions of years. It's not like we're going to see one of those stars turn on, as it were, in a century of astronomy. Occasionally you do read about something like that happening, and almost certainly what's happening there really is that there was an obscuring cloud which has moved away from that source. And so now we see that dot and it wasn't there before. But the whole process of star formation is not something that we can observe in a century. It takes millions of years. So the other thing we see, particularly in these giant molecular clouds, but other places too, is not just gas. So gas is kind of harmless because it's mostly transparent, and when it does absorb light, it does it at a particular wavelength. What's more problematic for astronomy is the dust. So the dust is condensed carbon, oxygen, and nitrogen stuff. So it might come in the form of little bits of graphite, for example, graphite with some ice on top of it. Those sorts of things make up solids, tiny solids, that are floating around along with all of this gas. So the gas itself is transparent. You might remember I said we can sometimes pick out these stars. It's the dust that makes this gas opaque. A priori, the nebula themselves would be transparent. Know if I have a picture of an obscuring cloud or not. Yeah. Doesn't look like it. The pictures are always unimpressive because what they are is we have a background of stars and there's some region where we don't see stars. And the question is it by chance that that there aren't any stars in that direction, or is there something between us and those stars that's obscuring the stars that are there? And actually, the history of astronomy, people went for the latter choice first. That is, I'm not sure what order I gave those in. Go for the idea that it's happenstance as opposed to obscuring material. So John Herschel is kind of famous for being the first professional astronomer. He proposed that those were, he called them holes in space, just happens occurrences where there was a depletion of stars along that line of sight that pointed towards the Earth. So it wasn't until 1900 or so that people started to believe that there really was an obscuring cloud of dust that was blocking the light that was coming from that area. And of course, it becomes clear if when we turn our carbon monoxide detecting telescopes, we see that there's a big carbon monoxide cloud right there, that what's going on is dust. But radio telescopes were really only invented after World War II. Okay, so stars form from gas in space. We want cold, dense gas. We're talking about molecular clouds. And what happens is basically a positive feedback sort of situation. We get here's kind of a lousy picture. Here's my cloud. We get a little bit of extra concentration of gas at this location, and it's going to pull gravitationally other gas to it, and we start to get this growing region of extra dense gas. So we can follow this protostar kind of on the HR diagram. So if we make our HR diagram, so remember this is temperature, where these are the hot stars and these are the cool stars, and we have the luminosity, and these are the bright stars, and these are the dim stars. And it usually helps to put the main sequence on here, which looks kind of like a diagonal line, kind of like that. It's not really a line. You remember it does actually curve down pretty noticeably there at the end, but close enough to that. So with stars in formation, we're going to start with things that are astronomical in size, that are huge, but still relatively rarefied, and cold. So stars are going to be first detected as things that are very big and very cold. And with time, they're going to contract, right? Remember that this is smaller radius. They're going to contract and heat until they join the main sequence. Now we can't actually see this sort of piece of this diagram, right? So those are stars that are very cool and they're still embedded in this giant molecular cloud which has a lot of dust in it. This piece we can see as very interesting objects embedded in giant molecular clouds. And maybe we'll talk more about these sorts of objects, T Tauri objects, named for the constellation Taurus in which they were first noticed, which seem to be stars that are about to turn on, as it were. So we'll pick up that next time.